Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Miriam Shirley Schultz, and I'm one of the hosts of this channel. I'm very happy to welcome Daniel Bojarin to the show today. Daniel doesn't really need an introduction. He is Professor Emeritus of Talmudic Culture at the University of California, Berkeley, and has been one of the most influential and paradigm-shifting scholars in Jewish studies generally, and of rabbinic culture and the study of Judaism and Christianity specifically. His work has been so extensive that I can only mention a few of his seminal books here. His publications include Carnal Israel, Reading Sex and Talmudic Culture, which came out in 1993, Dying for God, Martyrdom, and the Making of Judaism and Christianity, came out in 1999, Queer Theory and the Jewish Question, 2003, A Traveling Homeland, The Babylonian Talmud as Diaspora, 2015, and Judaism, The Genealogy of a Modern Notion in 2018. Today, we will be discussing his new provocative book, The No State Solution, A Jewish Manifesto, that came out with Yale University Press earlier this year. In it, Daniel pleads for a new understanding of Jewish peoplehood as a diaspora nation, and sketches an alternative vision for a Jewish future beyond the nation state and the Zionist totality we allegedly live in. Looking at the state of Jewish statehood, the timing for this manifesto could admittedly not be better. So let's dive in and sketch with you that alternative as you see it, Daniel. So hi, Daniel. Wonderful to have you and welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course, anytime. Okay, let's start. The No State Solution, A Jewish Manifesto, that's really an amazing title. But let me start this interview with the question that you end your manifesto with. What were you thinking? Or put differently, how did you come to this project and why now?
Thank you. I would say that I've been coming to this project or to this book through my entire adult life. Although I, in my youth, that is, as a teenager and early college student, considered myself and was committed to a kind of leftist Zionism, that, sort of the Mapam variety. It's not accidental, of course, that Mapam no longer exists. But over the years, particularly of living in Israel, and I did live in Israel for 17 years. I'm an Israeli citizen, carrying an Israeli passport, served in the Israeli army, not as a regular soldier, but as a reserve soldier, because of my age at the time that I went to live there. Through my years living in Israel, I came to feel that the combination of Jewish statehood, a state defined as a Jewish state, and a very significant, and after 67, enormous minority population for whom this state had declared that it was not theirs, was simply a moral impossibility, that liberal Zionism, so-called liberal Zionism, let alone leftists or radical Zionism, radical leftist Zionism, were simply an oxymoron, you know. And so my thoughts about that grew and developed over decades. And at the same time, my commitment to Jewish peoplehood and to the continued existence of a vibrant Jewish culture as a significant, crucial value also developed and stronger, to the point where I have felt that I was in a kind of an aporia, a dead end with no exit, owing to these contradictions. This book is an attempt to break through that aporia and to find a way through it to a different kind of future for Jewish peoplehood than the disaster, catastrophe with which we are living now, owing to what I consider and considered already 20, 25 years ago, the inevitable result of the Zionist theory. Right? It was, by the way, it was this disaster was also pretty much predictable already in 1921. In the exchange, as it were, never actually took place as an exchange, but of letters between Sholem and Rosenzweig, in which Sholem already understood that the attempt to secularize the Hebrew language, it has to be understood as a metaphor, right? But a very, very powerful metaphor for the Har Gaash, the volcano, that but overflowing its banks and killing everything.
That's a beautiful correspondence between the two. And Rosenzweig, of course, is very important also in your book. But let me go back to the actual title. You subtitled the book A Jewish Manifesto, echoing the calls for new modes of thinking so pervasive in programmatic statements of various political movements, left and right, and the cultural avant-garde of like 100 or so years ago, including, of course, movement Jewish movements of various stripes. So I have a general several questions regarding this format. What was different in form about writing a manifesto and a Jewish manifesto from your other writing? Was there a difference? And who are you debating directly? And what do you want to dethrone, which is also part, of course, of the manifesto? And then finally, what is the desired audience? Who do you want to mobilize?
Those are great questions. But there are four. Those are four questions masquerading as one. I'm afraid.
Yes.
Yes. It's a manifesto because it is the piece of all of my book length writings, at any rate, that is most directed towards a specific vision for the future. I don't like to use either the term political or religious for various intellectual reasons that people are following the latest discourses in religious studies will follow, and others will understand what I mean as I go along. But this is, one could say that most of my books have had some kind of a polemical or future-oriented focus. Recovery, redemption, fragments of redemption, partial redemption of the past towards a better future. But this is the one that has the most specific designs on the world, namely the claim that essentially the Jewish state is a disaster for the Jews, which is, that's why it's a Jewish manifesto in a sense, right? This is, obviously the disaster is made out of the effects that it has on other people as well. Effects that we are seeing now, you know, turn on the news in the morning and, it's the latest gun massacre in the United States and the latest activities of the Jewish Falange, as I call them, in Israel, joyfully burning down a village and not worrying over much or indeed rejoicing in Palestinian deaths. But the future that I am engaged in is the effect on Jewish peoplehood and its possibility as a result of that state. In this particular book, I mean, that's the focus in this particular book, and this is a Jewish manifesto. And the question is, in a sense, how can the Jewish people survive after Zionism, right? The book assumes that Zionism is the direct and proximate cause of the evil that we see being enacted there. And I've always felt that it could only come to an increasingly evil end. And we see that now. And then what next? Do we have to abandon Jewishness? Many of my colleagues, progressive colleagues, various stripes, are saying regretfully or joyfully, they're arguing for cosmopolitanism and saying that the problem is the very specific notions of identity and concern for identity and specific culture. And this book comes to reject that vigorously and propose at least a dream of a future for the Jews. So it is a Jewish manifesto, both in the polemical focus of the argument. The point of this book is not to make philological innovations or scholarly innovations, but to argue for a specific project in the world. Now, I just want to say that polemical or not, manifesto or not, I always intend to make my writing dependent on good scholarship, right? As opposed to the lawyer who argued in front of the Supreme Court last week and won the right for public businesses to deny service to LGBT people on the basis of a total fabrication. I tried to avoid even little fabrication to make the argument.
Yeah, I think that's why you have the standing that you have, because you're an amazing scholar. So there's no doubt that it's deeply researched and it's an amazing book. Yeah, definitely not the Supreme Court lawyer, for sure not. But again, going back to the title, you actually had an original title that was different from the one that ended up being the title. So that title was "What Is the Juice?"
Right.
Can you elaborate on this? What did you intend?
That was, you know, the original intellectual project, in a sense. It actually became more of a manifesto, but once it had a manifest-ish, I doubt if that adjective has ever been used before, a manifest-ish title, right? Then it sort of, the title drove it more and more in a polemical direction. But the question that underlies it, you know, what is the Jews a religion? Is the Jews a nation? Is the question legitimate? Is there a different way of asking the question, a different way of posing the question? I think it's fortunate, actually, that a lot of people, not only my editors at Yale, thought that "What Is the Juice?" is an ugly title. I still like it. But on the other hand, it's certainly not the title of the book that I wrote in the end.
Right. So the new title kind of drove the way that you wrote, ultimately, that manifestish kind of writing. That's interesting, that it really changed the way also that you conceived of this book. That's really interesting. But so you already mentioned it. So what is the Jews is kind of, as you say, the new Jewish question. And you claim that now there are two seemingly mutually exclusive conceptions that hegemonically define what the Jews are. They are either a religion or a nation, and as a nation, they inherently need a state. And you argue against either. So why, in your view, are Jews not a religion? Why is a nation not inherently statist? What is problematic about these conceptions?
Okay. But again, you smuggled 11 questions at the guise of one. But each one of them could take a volume to answer. But I'll try to sketch out the chapter headings of an answer to Rashi Prakim. First of all, the whole question of religion, not of religiosity but the conception of religion as a distinct and separate phenomenon within human culture, and as a separate sphere in society as well, has been brought into very, very, very sharp question by scholars who are and historians who are far more serious and far more important than I am vis-a-vis this question, beginning with Talal Asad, one of the great intellectuals of our time. So it becomes difficult to speak altogether about a religion. Okay. From one perspective, I would argue that Christianity is the only religion on earth. That is, the only collective that defines itself by the holding of certain intellectual commitments and not much else, at least in its self-definition, right? Whereas the Jews, like most other peoples, have always had a kind of inextricable weaving of practices practices and including verbal practices, linguistic practices that are oriented towards the sacred and all the other practices that make up human lives together. And so and when we just start looking at the Jewish people, on a phenomenological level or a descriptive level, empirical level, it becomes increasingly difficult. I mean, the more we look, the harder it gets to. I heard a shocking conversation between two American Jewish teenagers, older teenagers, that I think practically almost would never have been uttered before very recently. One said to the other, you know, I'm not Jewish because I don't have any religion, right? A little over 100 years ago, Sigmund Freud was calling himself a godless Jew and saying he has no religion, but he is very much a Jew, and indeed he was very much a Jew. And I just take that as a particular example that I think makes the point that Jewishness, you know, what is the Jews, cannot be answered by saying a religion, but if for no other reason then we would be excluding from Jewness lots and lots of people that we don't exclude in practice, right? You know, and that we don't exclude in our own practice, including, I would say, most varieties of Orthodox Judaism. So there is when Lubavitchers turn to Jews because they want to bring them to the Torah or bring them to the religious life, there would be no Jews if they out there to bring in, right? So if we didn't recognize a much broader character of the collective, although I'm gradually becoming persuaded by folks that it was a mistake to want to revivify the notion, the word nation.
You do? Okay. We will talk about this.
Yeah. Because people say it's just so poisoned, you know, that for lots of people can't say nation or nationalism without them thinking of Nazis. And I think that's tragic because I still think that nation was, so only very recently, very powerful and positive conception that has gotten poisoned, but you know, rivers get polluted and we can unpollute them, but maybe this one is so polluted, you know, that it's the Gowanus Canal of concepts of collectives, you know, this stage impossible to unpollute, but I still don't find a word that I like better. People just sounds to me so federation, the Jewish people, so, you know, neoliberal and parva. And I want something that's fleshic, but not toxic. So,
I mean, you make the important intervention or distinction between a nation that is bound to a nation state, which, of course, I think is really indefensible by now, and a nation that is diasporic. And, of course, the idea of a diaspora nation is in and of itself not at all new in Jewish thought and practice, and not in Jewish studies, of course. So you develop your idea specifically out of a deep engagement with the Talmud, but you do also gesture to movements like Bundism and, I don't know if you agree, a more secular concept of Doigkeit. And of course, Yiddish land of the Yiddish imaginary was at least on my mind, as well as was Simon Dubnov and his ideas about a diaspora nationalism. So what is new about your diaspora nationalism in the face of state Zionism? We cannot think it without that right now, right? And then what could nowadays Doigkeit look like?
Well, as you know, in the book, I have a kind of at least preliminary account of Doigkeit to translate it into the terms that I need from it. In other words, a Jewish diaspora nationalism that is at the same time that it has this commitment to other Jews and to Jewish culture and Jewish history is also fully embedded in the search for justice wherever we are, right? So a kind of dual homeland and dual loyalty. I know that that's an anti-Semitic trope, but I think that is the antidote to the kind of ethno-nationalism that the anti-Semites were throwing against the Jews. You're not really committed to Deutschland. You're not really committed to the Magyars because you've got this other thing, or even to the American academic version of it, where Jews couldn't possibly be professors of English literature because you're not really devoted to, you know, you've got this Hebrew stuff and this Yiddish stuff and this, which are and disturbing. So it's precisely a kind of an attempt to articulate a sort of dialectic of nationalism in a permanent dialectic, you know, Mashtikal Trotskyist, a permanent, a little more than a shtickle, actually, notion that these two things can be and must be balanced, or one of them will have to go. And as I say right there, right in the beginning, the one that would have to go, if it's impossible to co-articulate this, is the Yiddishkeit, I'm afraid.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Right? Now, that could be debated. You know, that's a question of a value, but I said, without justice, without a search for justice, without a commitment to universal welfare, then we would have to let go of the specific, the particular diasporic commitments and culture. But I'm trying to argue that we don't have to let go. So because as far as I can see, universalism, or not universalism so much as cosmopolitanism, always means being absorbed into whatever cultural form happens to be dominant.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so territory is not so important in your, or not at all important actually, in your conceptualization, but language really is. And in this, I would argue you are very much in line with like 19th century conceptions of nationalism. For instance, pre-1871 German nationalism, but of course also Jewish nationalisms, diasporic or not. Only now in your account, given the diversity of Jews, this national language cannot simply be Yiddish. So I would like you to elaborate on this, like why the importance of one national language as opposed to the embrace of Jewish multilingualism, as we've also seen Jewish thinkers vouch for, right? And then also, for me, there's a contradiction here to your alignment with Aimé Césaire's universalism as the coexistence of many differences. But maybe this is my misreading of your argument.
No, it's complicated. I mean, I think that's probably the most difficult theoretical and intellectual part, and therefore the least, in some ways, the least satisfactory. I tried to imagine and I didn't quite say this in the book, but it comes out between the lines, a Jewish part language, right? You know, in other words, that the kind of shared inflection of language, and I partly mean that even in the sense of inflection as, you know, Stalin reading a telegram. This is a joke. Reading a telegram from Trotsky that says, "You were right. I was wrong. Long live the revolution." And a Jewish delegate, you know, to the Politburo picks up the telegram and says, "No, it says you were right. I was wrong. Long live the revolution." You know, so that inflection in that sense, but inflection also in a more complex sense of the lexicon, the shared lexicon, which itself is always hyphenated, right? It's always hyphenated so that so a language that incorporates Yiddish Teich, right? Which means Jewish German, right? Jewish Spanish, Jewish Tajik, Jewish Persian, Judeo-Arabic, obviously. Also, that the common features. That's what I tried to make the beginnings of an argument for. That there's this common linguistic features that it's not just languages written in Hebrew characters, but a kind of combination of content, of inflection, of habits of speech that come from study of the Talmud. You know, eating, I won't eat, but drinking, I'll have a schnapps. You know, that kind of it actually comes straight out of the Talmud, right? Yatovi yatvinen, baruch ilam mevachinen, right? On the eighth day of Sukkot, it says sitting, we don't sit, i.e., we don't. Have that Or sitting, we do sit, sorry. Sitting, we do sit, but making a bracha, we don't make a bracha. That's exactly the way, a literal translation of the Aramaic. And we can see how that that kind of speech pattern lives on in Jewish language. So, sometimes half joking, I'd say that the Jewish language is going to be Yinglish, right? Because English is already a kind of a universal lingua franca. So, and after all, Jewish language is developed from, grew through the use of non-Jewish languages by Jews. So why shouldn't there be a Judeo version? And if it's founded on English lexicon, it could be something that. But that's only one, and as I say, half joking. The other thing that's happening is Hebrew is becoming a kind of universal. Now, the question is, we have to distinguish between two kinds of Hebrew also, because if Hebrew is Israeli, I mean, the language of Israel, and that kind of Hebrew, then I don't think we've accomplished very much to get beyond. But Hebrew does not have to be, the only the Israeli language. That could be Israeli Hebrew, and I have this fantasy of a language called Judeo Hebrew, right? So,
yeah, you also speak of a world Hebrew. My friend Todd Hibowski, that you of course also know, works on this idea of the diasporic Hebrew. So there are all of these ideas of how to kind of separate Hebrew from the state of Israel. And of course, by more and more Israelis also leaving the country, Hebrew will develop into something else as well as they live.
But it's a wonderful thing for me. If wherever I am, if I walk into a kosher store and I can't speak the language at all, I mean, I have no trouble with German and little trouble with French on that level of ordering food in the store. But there are places I go, where I don't. There's always somebody in the store who speaks Hebrew, and that becomes the medium of. That it's usually somebody who's been to Israel or spent time in Israel so there is still a in some ways I think the greatest positive achievement of Zionism has been the revival of Hebrew. How many drops of blood justifies that achievement, and yet at the same time, and I think we have to somehow exploit the fact that so many people know Hebrew too.
I mean, it's just a reality that it also replaced so many other Jewish languages, just as Yiddish, for instance. It's just the reality that we live in. So I already touched on Cézanne and your alignment with his idea of universalism. So one important aspect of the book is your engagement with the Black radical tradition, particularly Frantz Fanon and Aimé Césaire, and also the tradition of Negritude, as well as nowadays Black study. And to me, I think you continue your dialogue that is rather longstanding in the Yiddish radical tradition, if we want to call it that, and also, of course, vice versa. So the Black radical tradition really kind of looked at the Jewish condition to make claims about the Black experience as well. Yeah, so what were these thinkers offering your project?
I have absolutely no need to be innovating. That's, you know, even in my more, let's say, more sober, more academic a lot of my work has been reviving ideas that were sort of fell by the wayside, and perhaps recombining them, or combining them into a new discursive framework. This is one difference between Western scholarship and traditional Jewish scholarship. And despite it all, I feel myself very much in the traditional Jewish scholar. My colleagues, some very, very well-meaning colleagues, why do you quote all the time? Why are you always commenting on things that other people wrote? Why don't you just lay out your ideas? I don't know how to do that. But I am writing a super, 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 super commentary on everything that Jews and a lot of non-Jews have written. And lest people misunderstand, super does not mean better. It means a commentary on commentaries and commentaries on commentaries. That's the way I think. That's the way my ideas develop. That's how I write. And nothing thrills me more than discover that something that I thought is or already there in Du Bois or the Lubavitcher Rebbe or Rosenzweig or even to discover that Herzl and Pinsker would barely qualify as Zionists on contemporary definitions. Not that I'm an apologist for them, and more do I want to redeem their ideas, although there are things that can be learned from them.
Yeah, I mean, you make the point that there's nothing inevitable in history. It didn't have to end this way inherently to these Zionist thinkers. There were, of course, so many different ideas floating around. But there's one idea, I think, that is new, thinking of the Talmud as Jewish jazz, producing the sounds of a diasporic Jewish sociality, and you're drawing here, of course, on Fred Noten's work on jazz. I was really struck by that idea, and I would like you to talk about that more, and also how it determined the style of the writing of this book. I mean, you already hinted at it, the continued conversation, but yeah, Jewish jazz,
yeah,
the Talmud.
Well, Fred, whom I can call Fred because we've become friends. This is not like everybody calling Judas Butler Judy. No. You know, this. Which really used to piss her off, and she was furious. She was furious that there was a zine called Judy, and things like that. Serious thinkers don't like becoming, cult object celebrities. Fred and others, not only Fred, have demonstrated, more than argued, they've demonstrated, and in part demonstrated through their own practices of you know, of writing. You don't read Fred Moten's work the way you read Donald Davidson's work or Quine's work. You know, it's something different. Which doesn't make it less serious or less intellectual, but it's in part a resistance against certain patterns that claim privilege as reason, as rationality. Mm. And I think that one part of the claim for Jewish jazz, which I'm going to be developing at much, much greater length, not necessarily under that figure, although also, is that so much of Jewish discourse centered around the Talmud, growing out of the Talmud, is a resistance to the modes of reason that are claimed as being the highest and the best. Right? So it's resistance to that kind of colonialism. So that's part of it, is that sort of parallel. But the other part is the sound and the sense of, you know, of how, and this is something that I've really learned to experience from two directions. One is the writing of the writings of the Black radical tradition, and the other is that I'm a grandson who's a jazz musician, and a fledgling jazz musician, I should probably say. He's 19, studying jazz at the New England Conservatory, from which some pretty impressive music grew over the last 80 years. Jewish, you know, the plasmatics come from there, as well as some very, very important African American rooted Black rooted jazz traditions. So I just have the sense of a less propositional and more soundscapey foundation and motivating this sociality, and in a sense that Talmud is so much more than a bunch of guys with white beards and black yarmulkes. It just inhabits Jewish verbal and even literary patterns, and even, you know, Woody Allen on the one hand, right? There's a deeply, deeply Talmudic sound to Woody Allen, and of course to Tapia, where it's more directly being represented. And even, not that I'm claiming any kind of status akin to Woody Allen, let alone Tapia, for myself, but in the forms of my even least directly Jewish discourses, you know. So that notion or experience of a soundscape making a sociality, producing a sociality, has been just profoundly moving to me, and I know that I've taken some pretty big risks in that section of the book, I tried to protect against the risks. I mean, not just cover my butt, but to prevent the kinds of misunderstandings that have made, you know, comparisons so pernicious, you know, you have the Middle Passage, we have the Holocaust, and the versions of that really are pernicious, precisely because they don't pay attention to right now. You know, there are ways of avoiding paying attention to the systemic racism on the one hand, the United States, and on the other hand, of Israel. And so,
I'm looking forward to what you'll do with the Jewish jazz and the soundscape.
Yes, I'm not necessarily going to continue with that particular representation of it, but my project for the summer here in Hamburg is to develop work that I've been doing on the anti-rationalism, and which doesn't mean necessarily mysticism and spirituality, but it means a kind of directed skepticism against reason as a the only way, or even the best way, to enhance Jew flourishing and even human flourishing.
This is a great way to end this wonderful conversation. I would like to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and to Daniel to talk to me today. This was Daniel Buyarin, and we were talking about his book, The No State Solution, A Jewish Manifesto, which came out with Yale University Press. Go read, discuss it, and take action. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. This is Miriam Scholli-Schultz for the New Books Network. Zeit gesund.